welcome to this week's Popcorn and Prosecco. This week we'll be reviewing In Your Eyes, Lock, and The Quiet Ones. Once again, we don't have Perry here because she's on the set of Child Eater, which we'll tell you more about next week. But in the meantime, we got me and Angie Han.
Hi!
So let's dig into this week's movie reviews. Angie?
All right, so the first thing that we want to talk about this week is In Your Eyes, which is the... You could think of it as a new Joss Whedon movie. It was actually directed by Bryn Hill, but Joss Whedon wrote it, and because he's the big name, this is probably going to be like Cabin in the Woods, where everyone is just like, oh, right, that Joss Whedon movie. Anyway, so the premise is that there are two main characters. One, played by Michael Stahl David, is an ex-con living in somewhere in the Southwest.
I think it's like New Mexico.
Yeah, it's like New Mexico or somewhere in that area. And then there's Zoe Kazan plays a bored New England housewife. And they've never met, but ever since they were children, they've had this sort of like metaphysical psychic connection where sometimes, and it seems to be really inconsistent, just like within the world of a movie, like sometimes they can kind of feel what the other person is going through. A lot of times it's like physical things, like the movie opens with like Zoe Kazan as like a 7-year-old or something crashing her sled into a tree, and then, you know, across the country, Michael Stahl David suddenly, like, he's in class or something, and he suddenly, like, falls down from his desk and is injured. And then other times it's emotional, like, at one point I think he's like, oh, Zoe Kazan, like, I should rewind, and sometimes they can also feel each other's, like, emotions or... It's a little bit unclear what kind of stuff they're experiencing. Anyway,
it's like a twin connection, but they're not twins. It's like when you hear about people, I'm not saying twins have that, but you hear about people being like, well,
yeah,
my twin got a heart attack and I did too, or something.
Basically. But then for some reason, one day when they're, what are they, maybe in their late 20s, 30s-ish age, their connection gets really intense and they find that they're actually able to talk to each other. Weirdly, they can't read each other's minds, so they have to, like, talk out loud to each other, which makes them both look crazy. And there are consequences of the fact that they both look crazy. And predictably, they sort of fall in love, and they're destined to be together because there's this metaphysical connection, et cetera, et cetera. They do have, like, other love interests. Like, she's married to a doctor who is... He's not quite Billy Zane in Titanic, but it's, like, very clear right off the bat that he's, like, evil, almost. And then he has Nikki Reed, which is just, like, a girl that he flirts with who is, like, really kind of ditzy. Anyway, so that's the story. I kind of thought, like, it's an interesting premise that they take in some not very interesting directions. I mean... The whole idea of, like, somebody being able to feel the things you feel and, you know, literally, like, that's kind of mind-blowing. And, like, if you think about, like, someone that you've been in a relationship, like, what would it be like to feel everything that they're feeling? But the movie doesn't really do that so much as just be like, oh, so it means they're metaphysically connected. They spend most of the movie just kind of, like, talking to each other. And because they're across the country and they don't actually know each other, when I say talking to each other, I mean you get scene after scene of, like, Michael Stahl David standing around his house looking out the window, like, laughing to himself and, like, talking to himself, and there's nobody there. And the way it's shot makes it
lots of staring into the mid-distance of this. So, like, this is basically a scene from the movie. What was it like when you were growing up as a kid? It was tough for me, too. And it's like they keep cutting back and forth, but it's not... it's not visually stimulating. It's like you want to be like, it's a movie, be a movie, but it's like it's one very long phone conversation, which is kind of funny, and we'll get into that why later. But like, that's the other thing, is that people keep calling them out on how weird they look, and occasionally they'll like haphazardly grab me like, oh, phone.
That drove me crazy. I was like, get a fucking Bluetooth headset and
just put it there, and people will think you're talking to someone, and you won't have to look like a crazy person. Like, that drove me nuts. Especially
because
also, they live in the age of the internet, and they never, like, I'm not saying it would have been interesting, but there's never a scene where one of them's like, I'm gonna see if I can Facebook this person, which just feels weird.
No, I feel like the weird thing about this movie is that it's basically a fairy tale. Like, it kind of goes by fairy tale logic more than, like, actual real world.
That's fair.
But the thing is that, like, some of their, like, especially earlier on, their interactions felt so natural and grounded and warm that it, I almost would have liked it if the performances earlier on were more heightened or more artificial feeling, because then I wouldn't have had these weird expectations that it should be more realistic, like that they should have learned about Bluetooth headsets or looked each other up on Facebook, or especially because it happens again and again where people go up to them and they're like, are you, like, talking to yourself, and they're just like, oh no. And like, you would think after the 100th time that happens, they'll be like, oh, I need to just put a Bluetooth. My brother does that with his girlfriend all the time. They just have Bluetooth headsets and talk to each other constantly. Do they look crazy? No, because they have a thing in.
Exactly. And like, that's kind of the problem, is that it becomes a reoccurring thing where people are like, they're so weird, they talk to themselves. And it's like, it's funny the first time, or maybe the first three times, but it just keeps happening. You're like, we've done this. Like, I remember reading about this, that Joss Whedon was saying it was a movie he had written that he just didn't have the energy to put together for a while. And, like, watching it, I feel like he just didn't have the interest to fully put it together. Like, his production company, Bellwether, produced it, but it feels so underthought and so undercooked. And, like, the thing is, I kept thinking it felt like a play, where if you were watching a play of this, you could have them both on the stage, but in, like, different lighting or different planes, and it would be visually interesting because your brain would know these are different locations and you could deal with that. And I kept expecting them to do split screen or something that would speak to the medium of film. And it doesn't. There's like one scene. I feel like I can say there's a sex scene because I feel like obviously there's a sex scene.
Oh yeah, we need to talk about the sex scene.
Well, I actually like the sex scene because like that's like for the first part of it, it's like they only feel each other whenever violence happens effectively. Like he gets punched in the neck and she's like, whoa, oh my God, I was at a dinner party. What happened? And like stuff like that. But then like they begin to focus and she's like, I want to know what you feel like, which is a hot moment. And then he like touches his face and it slowly evolves into a sex scene where then they start crossing that line and we see her hand on him, even though they're miles and miles and miles apart. And like, that was interesting to me. That is when you're taking advantage of the medium of film to tell this story. But like for most of the movie, it just felt like this story would make more sense as a short story or as a play. Like there's nothing visually specific about it. And watching him garden while she's like unpacking boxes and they're both idly chatting together is just really boring.
Yeah, they do a lot of activities that are clearly there because you can't just literally have Zoe Kazan sitting on the couch the whole time. There are lots of scenes where she's just sitting on the couch, and him too, but you can't have them just do that, so they'll be like, he likes to garden. Look, here he is gardening while he talks through a psychic link to Zoe Kazan. The sex scene... can I talk about the sex scene?
Oh, go ahead, sorry.
Okay, so I agree that that's one of the few times that you actually kind of... They kind of bring them together and it works. One thing I found interesting about it is how, like, female-gazy it is. Because she's like, oh, I want to know what you feel like. So then he starts caressing himself, like, very sensually. Which is something that you kind of see with, you know, like, when women are trying to be sexy in movies or whatever. You see that. You never really see a guy do that. And it's just like... Yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting. The other thing, though, is that even though it... I wasn't sure if it worked for me. On the one hand, like the things that you said I liked. On the other, the movie at some point just decides that it's going to be cheesy, and that was kind of the turning point for me, where it went from being like kind of sweet to like too sweet and like a little too like sugary. Well, and
there's no conflict in between the two lovers, really.
There's no conflict between them, and I would argue that even the conflicts that are outside of them are mostly half-assed. Like, he's an ex-con, so he's on parole, and he, like, needs to find a job, and, like, you know, his, like, old criminal associates are trying to bring him back to the life, and, like, you think it's going to be a thing. It's not really. It doesn't end up being that much of an issue. She has a little bit more of a problem because her husband thinks that she is crazy, which
feels really... old-timey. Like, it feels very yellow wallpaper, like 1800s, where he's like, I don't know, she talks to herself. Like, there's you can't get people locked up quite as easily as she is locked up in this movie.
I want to say, on the one hand, yes. On the other hand, first of all, this guy actually has a good reason to think that she's crazy, which is that she is constantly, like, reacting to things that she hasn't felt. Like, she'll, like, start screaming that her hands are on fire when they're clearly not, or something like that. Or she'll be, like, talking to herself and giggling to herself, and she apparently has, like, a history of being, like, a little bit unstable, so the fact that her moods are swinging, like, I'm not this guy, so I probably wouldn't, like, go and, like, try to do something as drastic as lock her up, but, like, I don't think that the movie makes it seem like it's unreasonable that he thinks she's being crazy, and I don't think it's at all unreasonable. If you started doing that, Christy, I'd be like, friends, we gotta get together and, like, stage an intervention and try to get her some help, because she is talking to herself and acting like she's been hit in the head when she's just sitting at a dinner party.
I also feel like the movie's really snotty, kind of, because the characters snark at each other's partners, and I get that because there's, like, a jealousy thing going on, but it does it within that, too, because it's, like, he's white trash from New Mexico, and she's, like, up in the nose up in the air or whatever, and like they make fun of them in such ways that I was just like, why am I supposed to like anybody in this movie? Like, because he's like, oh, I'm an ex-con, but I'm a good guy, and she's like, oh, I'm a fragile housewife, but I have feelings, and it's like, okay, like, it's not sure, but then they just want to make fun of like everyone else in his life and everyone else in her life, so they're the only people that matter. And it's like, where are they gonna go when you've established everyone in the world is a jerk except these two?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, basically, I think we should probably wrap up. But overall, I just thought that it starts out with an intriguing premise. It could have been an interesting experiment, but they took it in probably the least interesting ways that you could go. Like, the characters are charming to an extent because the actors who play them are very likable and they give, like, really likable performances. But they're not even, like, that complex or anything like that. So, I was, you know, it wasn't, like, the worst way that I've spent 2 hours, but it's not exactly... You know, I don't think there's any reason to, like, super run out and see it unless you're Joss Whedon completist.
Well, that's the thing. It's, like, it's really easy to see, so even if we're saying all this and you don't agree, or you're like, ah, but Joss Whedon forever, which, for the record, I think we're both Joss Whedon fans. This is just, this is very, this is, like, C-level Joss Whedon at best. It's not good stuff. But right now, it played at Tribeca, it's playing at Tribeca, and it's going to, it's online now. You can type in your eyes, and a website will come up where you can rent it for $5 and watch it. It's just, my problem with it is it doesn't feel terribly filmic.
I think it's worth $5 if you like the actors or if you like Joss Whedon. But I think if none of those things really apply, or you're like, I'd rather spend the $5 on a smoothie, then that is also perfectly valid.
Ooh, I would totally go with smoothie.
Actually, in retrospect, so would I.
That's our pull quote. We'd prefer a smoothie. Angie and Christy.
Yes. Anyway, so
moving on to a different phone conversation-centric movie.
Yes! Oh my god, you're right. They're very similar in that way. So the second movie we want to talk about this week is Locke, which stars Tom Hardy and was directed by Stephen Knight. And the entire movie this is so simple to explain. It's 90 minutes of Tom Cruise driving around.
Tom Hardy.
Tom Cruise. Why did I say Tom Cruise? It's so
Tom
weird.
Tom Hardy is cruising in a car. But,
I love that. Good save. Anyway, it's Tom Hardy driving around in the car taking phone calls. And that's it. That's the whole premise. I mean, there's a little bit...
I mean, you're right, but that sounds so... You're completely right. That is what the movie is, but it's like to just... That cracks me up. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There is some actual plot. Basically, he's a... what is he, like a construction foreman?
Foreman.
And he's driving from, I don't know where, but he's driving from somewhere that's about 90 minutes away, because this is in real time, toward London, where a woman that he had a one-night stand with, despite him being married, is giving birth to his baby. And his determination to do the right thing and be there for the baby, you know,
and this isn't a spoiler, because they divulged that in, like, 10 minutes in.
Yeah.
But at first, you don't know. Like, it just starts with him getting in a car and then starting to make phone calls. And you're like, what is going on? It slowly unfolds. It's not, you know, there's nothing quite so simple as him getting in and being like, I'm coming to see you and the baby. Boop, 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 boop. Like,
yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, and then this leads to his decision to do that leads to his marriage hitting some rough patches, because he neglected to tell his wife that this was happening until he is in the car in the movie. And also, this leads to some professional troubles, because apparently this is right before he has like some massive project that only he can handle, that's like, you know, a really big deal for the company.
It is a literally groundbreaking project, and also metaphorically groundbreaking.
I think they do a little heavy hand. They do some... several heavy-handed metaphors, but yeah, anyway.
Guys, cement is a metaphor. Know that.
There is a lot of talk about cement in this movie. Anyway, so I thought overall that it was, I guess it's kind of like In Your Eyes Again, where I was like, this is an interesting experiment. I don't necessarily know that there is that much more to it. Tom Hardy is very good in it. There are not that many people that I could watch drive around for 90 minutes and take phone calls, but he makes it work, although he has a weird Welsh accent that I'm not convinced is very accurate, because it just sounds kind of odd, but I don't know, maybe I'm being offensive.
Well, Wales is furious right now.
I actually Googled around, and some people were like, what was that Tom Hardy? Like, Welsh people were like, what was that Tom Hardy? So maybe it's not just me. So
I
don't
know. It's weird. It's I don't know what he sounds like. I should have looked that up. I'm actually curious. But yeah, the accent, you're like, for American audiences, we're like, where is he from? What's happening? But it's interesting. I mean, it is just him sitting in a car. It is him sitting in a car for the entire running span. I mean, you know, like literally the very beginning and literally the very end for like 30 seconds, he's not in the car, but it's all him in a car dealing with this thing, which is actually surprisingly interesting. And as Angie said, like, not a lot of actors can make, I mean, we like to make jokes and you're like, oh, so-and-so is so interesting, I would listen to them read the phone book. And it's like, how many actors would you actually want to watch take phone calls for an hour and a half? But it's pretty interesting. And if you're wondering, how do you fill an hour and a half with this? He's calling his wife to explain to her what happened. He keeps calling his sons. Well, he keeps calling the house, and his sons keep picking up. And they're like, Dad, the soccer game's on. Are you watching the soccer game? So, like, that's a whole nother, like, he has to diffuse that situation and not tell them what's going on yet. He has to talk to his second-in-command at work to get him prepared for the next day. He has to talk to his bosses, who are furious with him because he took off abruptly. And then he has to talk to this other woman who he doesn't have the kind of relationship you might expect.
Yeah, that was really interesting because basically it's someone that he worked with on like an offsite project once, so they know each other, but they're not, they make it pretty clear that not only are they not like madly in love, they're not even really friends.
No, apparently. They don't even just kind of like each other very much.
No, there's actually kind of a funny sad scene where in the beginning where she's like in the hospital, she's calling him, she's like, do you love me? And he's like, nope.
And yeah, he basically says, he's like, why are you asking that? And it made everybody in our theater laugh, but like, you don't know what their relationship is exactly yet. And then as they continue to explore it, you understand why she said that and why he said that. And, you know, and yeah. It's also additionally scary. Like, you might think like, well, why wouldn't he have told his wife? This seems terrible planning. Well, basically he found out and then like was trying to figure out how to deal with it. And then she ran into complications. So the pregnancy came even earlier than expected. And that's part of the mounting dramas, and he keeps getting phone calls from the hospital and they're like, where are you? Like, she's freaking out and this is a bad situation. And they keep saying, are you the daddy or are you her husband? And he has to keep like dealing with that.
They keep asking him like, are you her partner? And he keeps saying, no, I'm the baby's father.
Right. And it's actually, then they loop that back into his own backstory. And it's, you learn a lot about him within this hour and a half span. And I can totally understand why Tom Hardy took the part, because I feel like this is the kind of role that like a lot of actors would just love to do, because it's just, it is almost a monologue for an hour and a half. Like, it's really scary to take something like that on.
It's actually a one-man show. Yeah.
It is. And you know what? I got to say that even though we never see any other characters, there's some really good voice performances. Like, you've got, I'm going to forget, Olivia Colman, who I love. Is that right? Is it Colman?
I think so.
She's on Peep Show, which if you haven't watched the British show, Peep Show, it's really great. And she was in like Tyrannosaur, and like she's a British actress who does really amazing work, and she's in this. And
Ruth Wilson.
Yeah, Ruth Wilson's in it. She's the wife, right?
I will look it up on IMDb right now. Yes.
And then I've Andrew something.
Andrew Scott.
Thank you. He's Moriarty from BBC Sherlock, and he's like one. I kept thinking it was Chris O'Dowd, and then when I found out it was
so
him, that makes sense too. He sounds like Chris O'Dowd, and then you're like, oh no, you're Moriarty, but not crazy. So it's actually kind of cool because like I'm used to him being Moriarty, so I'm used to his. I think Moriarty on Sherlock is basically him from Powerpuff Girls. Like if you listen to the voices, I'm like convinced that's where he came from with it. But in this, it's very different. It's much more like Chris O'Dowd. And he does a really good job because, like, you get it and you feel for these characters even though you're not seeing them. And I think they did something really interesting here, but it is something that, like, it's not a particularly cinematic movie. I'm not going
to
say not
so. I was about to ask you that because I think it was kind of like In Your Eyes, we were talking about how that one kind of would have made almost more sense as a play. And that was a complaint that I've heard a lot of people say about Locke, which I think I kind of agree with. There's a lot of parts where this feels much more like, you know, a play than a movie. Especially there's a lot of parts where Tom Hardy starts talking to his imaginary friend who is basically like his deceased father that he's angry about. And
dead,
it's a
deadbeat dad.
Yeah, so he has like all these like rants directed at the back seat, even though there's no one there, and all of that kind of felt like a very like theatrical choice to me, not a cinematic one.
It feels masturbatory, frankly. It feels like it must feel good to perform those scenes, but I don't know how interesting they are to watch. But having said that, I don't think I would recommend people see this in the theater because it's just not interesting on that level where you it doesn't need to absorb you the way certain
movies do. It's not like a
run,
don't walk kind of movie, no.
Yeah, exactly. But like, you know, when it comes out on VOD, or if you're a really big Tom Hardy fan, I can totally say, like, watching this is interesting. Like,
it's a really good showcase for his talents.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll say that. Like, it's, yeah, so
and
it's
interesting because it's like he's gotten very good at playing, which is funny because like my first exposure to him was oh my god, why the begins with a B?
Bronson,
thank you. Was Bronson, where he's this big, larger than life theatrical character, and then it's like he does The Dark Knight Rises, where he talks like this the whole time, and it's like this weird monotone, kind of played down, like it's theatrical but mellow at the same time, and then in Lawless, he's like very calm, he's wearing a cardigan, and then in this again, he's very calm, he's like always almost talking like this, where he's like coaching everybody else through this very tough time. And it's really compelling. Like, it doesn't feel one note. It's really interesting to me how he can do these performances that are almost monotone, but they have a great deal of layers and depth and variety even within this, like, constraint. So, like, it's, I feel like if you really love actors, this is an interesting movie to see. If you really love Tom Hardy, this is an interesting movie to see. But I don't really think you have to see it in theaters.
Yeah, co-signed. I think that's exactly what I would say as well. So do you want to move on to our last review of the day?
Yeah. So this week, our big review is for The Quiet Ones, a horror movie said to be based on a true story.
They all are these days.
I know, right? It's one of those things where you're like, are we? Oh, there was a person who existed once, but
right.
I don't really understand how closely related this is to a true story.
Probably none.
but it does. It feels like it could be in several respects. The plot line is essentially, it's set in 1974 at Oxford University, where a professor played by Jared Harris from Mad Men and Sherlock Holmes' Game of Shadows is committing an experiment because he believes that poltergeists and demonic possessions are our way of trying to explain something we don't understand about our own bodies. He essentially believes that mental illness can manifest supernatural activity, and that it's not actually supernatural, it's just the product of a deranged mind. So to prove this, he has kind of taken custody of this very sick girl who has been experiencing all kind of problems, who's been bounced around for fast foster programs for years, who doesn't remember much about her own life because of all this and all this trauma. And he is trying to cure her. But the university is like, no, this is super shady, we're shutting you down. And he's like, you're not shutting me down. And he moves his teeny little group of people who are doing this experiment to a house that is creepy, because obviously. And they lock her up, they deprive her of sleep, they try to get her to induce this poltergeist that is haunting her. And shit goes down.
Yeah, and we should add that he has three assistants helping him with this. Two of them are, I guess, like graduate students or something. Yeah, who are always like screwing each other. And then one of them is Sam Claflin, whom you may know as Finnick from Hunger Games, playing a completely different role. He is not a student. He's like a townie, basically, who gets hired to be the cameraman and document everything. And he is the protagonist of the movie, more or less.
Yeah, because basically, he comes into this from an uneducated perspective, and he's been hired just to film what happens. But when he watches what they do to this girl, he can't just watch is the problem. Like, he keeps stepping
out. This is one of those movies where very early on they're like, now Sam Claflin, you are never to talk to this girl. And the next scene he starts talking to her, and nobody gives a shit. So
yeah.
He's one of those movies where they're like, here are some ironclad rules, you must never break them, and then they immediately do, and nobody cares.
Thematically, it's interesting because it's like it's like partially found footage. They're playing really fast and loose with it, especially because he's shooting on a camera that doesn't record sound, but his footage records sound. Just let that shit go. Like if you're paying attention to that, just let it go. You'll have a better time with the movie.
I thought it was we've seen so many found footage movies that I was just kind of glad to see a different kind of found footage movie.
It's
a little bit more like sinister in that, you know, the footage is part of the movie and it's like incorporated into the plot, but it's not really a found footage movie where they pretend that these are all tapes that they just found lying around.
That's a good comparison. And yeah, I think it's interesting because like, it's a Hammer film, which they've been coming back with things like The Woman in Black, and they're kind of I discussed this in my review for Cinema Blend. I feel like we're coming to a place in horror where we're getting really saturated with horror movies, and you're kind of got to make a decision about what kind of horror movie you're going to go to. Are you going to go to the kind that's going for splashy, you know, garish horror that's just like blood and guts, and who cares if the plot makes sense, blood and more guts? Or are you going to go for something that's like trying to harken back to, I think, like 1970s horror, like The Exorcist or Jaws, where you have a really interesting story that's also trying to be terrifying? And I think Quiet Ones is going that way. It's trying to give you a really interesting story with genuine human drama and also make it scary. I think it succeeds on the first point better than the second.
I think that the genuine human drama was, to me, I don't think it was scary at all, honestly. There are some points that are creepy. There are a couple of jump scares, but it's not really... It wasn't one of those movies where I was just, like, sitting, like, tense. Like, I was just like, okay, this is happening. It's a little bit creepy, but nothing... I don't even think that I would have been scared of this when I was younger. But I think the main thing to recommend about it is that it really is, like you said, like a compelling story with very human drama going on. It's, you know, so you have Jared Harris's character who he's a really interesting character. He's not really a bad guy. He's definitely not a good guy. He's one of those people that's like so blinded by his ambition that he's doing horrible things. You have Sam Claflin's character who's very conflicted about what he's doing, but also because he's like developing feelings for this little girl. Well, she's not little. She's like 18. She just acts like she's very young.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that part of it was, you know, they obviously have some conflicts with each other, and that part of it was really interesting to me. Less interesting to me was, like, the mythology, and, like, of course, eventually they're, like, they have to, like, go look at books and frown a lot and, like, decode special symbols and, like, oh my god, it was this all along and blah, 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 but that part of it to me, at that point, it just started to feel more like just, you know, every other horror movie I've seen.
No, I agree. I think it goes off the rails a little bit in its third act, especially because I think that the, as you said, the conflict between Jared Harris's character and
Sam Claflin.
Thank you. Their characters is actually interesting because it's one of on one level, like class, where like he's an educated professor and he's a blue collar, you know, worker, and they have this conflict there. But then additionally, it's also a struggle over this girl who like wants so badly to please Jared Harris because he's trying to rescue her, but then also is like kind of flirting with this other guy. And there's a lot of interesting things going on with it. I don't think all of them pay off quite as well as I had hoped. I did find it scary I found I was tense at moments. I think there's some good buildups. I don't think it's not scary like Paranormal Activity or something where like people are going to scream in the theater. It's not that kind of movie. It's a little quieter. I mean, it's more like The Woman in Black where like parts of it are creepy and you might be like, ooh, but it's more aiming for like disturbing and unsettling. And I think the setting of 1970s like university study is actually really solid for that because like I've seen enough documentaries about just things that so they were like trying to do something good, but like completely blind, like this character so wanted to accomplish the thing that they thought would better mankind that they were blind to what they were doing to the people in the journey. And I think that's an interesting story.
Yeah, I wouldn't have minded if they explored it even more, but then I guess at that point it would move even further away from horror.
I think that's kind of the trick. It's like it's trying to split the difference, and I don't think it always succeeds in doing that in the neatest way.
Yeah, to me this felt less like, I mean, it's a horror film, but it mostly just felt like a drama. I don't know, maybe because I found it less scary than you did, it felt almost like a drama with horror elements as opposed to just like
I'd agree with
scary
that.
Movie. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'd call it a drama with, I mean, yeah, I'd agree with that flat out. So I mean, like, if that's the thing, if you're looking for something that's just going to rattle you to your bones, then I can't really recommend The Quiet Ones on that level, but I did think it was genuinely really fun. I thought it was fun. I liked the story a lot, and like, I kind of kept going back to it for the next couple of days and just remembering certain scenes that I thought were really nicely played. Like, there's a character in this who's basically, like, the oversexed co-ed who, like, got into the whole project. She's a crush on Jared Harris's professor. And that's such a potentially one-dimensional role, but the way the actress who played it, like, I thought she was interesting and funny and, like, had a little more depth to her than typically, like, the bimbo.
Yeah, I mean, just like how you were saying that the characters are very, there's a lot more emphasis on, like, characterization and character development than you would normally see in a movie like this. And she's a good example of that. She doesn't have that much to do, but they cast someone who would make the most of what she was given. It's also kind of just funny. For me, one of the things that was kind of funny about it was just seeing the guy that plays Finnick playing this like very like closed in, awkward, kind of like, you know, not very confident type. He's like a one, he's it's like a 180 degree difference. Like,
yeah.
And I actually think that he looks not very much like himself as Finnick, so he doesn't even look like that character, even the same guy. So that was,
yeah, it's,
I mean,
funny. It's like they give him brown hair and they put him in these big sweaters that cover his brawn, and it makes him a totally different character. I mean, like, I know that's the whole point of costuming, but it's astonishing how they're really small changes. But
yeah.
It's like, I completely believed him, even though he's quite handsome, I completely believed him as this kind of like quiet and introverted guy who's having a hard time dealing with all these feelings and thoughts that this experiment stirs up in him.
Yep, he's also got a really fun 70s haircut.
It's true, it's true. Yes. So, do you want to wrap up for this week?
Sure, so those are the three movies reviewed this week, and now we are going to go, because all good things must come to an end eventually. If you liked what you've seen in this episode, you can follow us on at popcornprosecco.com. You can find us on YouTube at popcornprosecco. You can find us on Twitter at, you guessed it, popcornprosecco. I'm Angie Han, and you can find me at on Twitter at AJHAN, and you can also find my writing at SlashFilm. And Chrissy?
I'm Christy Puchko. You can find me often at CinemaBlend. I'm also recapping Game of Thrones for the Mary Sue. And you can find me at Twitter at Christy Puchko, KristyPuchko. And Perry is on Twitter at PNemiroff, PNemiroff.
Yes, and you should follow her because she's been posting some really fun updates from the set of Child Eater, the movie she's working on.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. They're sharing with a lot more stuff than sets usually do, and it's pretty creepy. The Instagram stuff especially is pretty sweet.
Yeah, so that's it for us this week. Have a good rest of your day, weekend, life, whatever. And see you next time.